The mind of God, yes. And the Gentiles who became Christians are considered Jews. The Israel of God, Galatians. Note this. You see the category? I'll start with this tomorrow, but this is very important to understand the book of Romans, and it has tremendous eschatological implications. By the way, to say that God has two peoples, that the Jews, the modern Jews who are in rebellion against God and Christ certainly, are the people of God, is blasphemy. Well, it's utter unbelief. You have to throw the book of Romans out in another book. It says there is no distinction, and that's the whole point. That was the very thing they were arguing. Are y'all following this discussion? Very significant. And they have this attitude, well, we are Abraham. And he said, that's the thing that never happened. Except that God will use you to bring certain things to the world. But it doesn't do with your salvation. Any more than God using Pharaoh. Had anything to do with Pharaoh's salvation. Pharaoh did not go to heaven because God used it in Egypt.
You know, some of the dispensationalists today think that the Jew himself, especially the Jewish Christian, is on a higher level than the rest of
us. Listen, there's whole groups of Jewish messianic movements put out a whole body of literature, the general dispensationalists. Radio called the Christian Jew Hour. Mm-hmm. They get on the radio. Jews for Jesus, trying to build on this distinction. Utterly unbiblical. The Bible doesn't teach that the Bible, Book of Romans and the Book of Galatians does not teach that there's no distinction. It doesn't teach anything. That was the whole point of the Book of Romans. Well, let's pick this up tomorrow, okay? Monday. Assume that the return of Israel to the land included the promise of a complete restoration of the Davidic kingdom. By the way, in all this, in this restoration prophecies and the throne of David prophecies, which we're looking at next, what the prophets have done and the psalmist of this is what God has done through them is use the throne of David as the rubric under which he includes the positive hopes of Israel. By this I mean the days of David were the glory days of Israel. Never better. That's when Israel was in there. Was his greatest. This greatness was lost under David's son Solomon. But Israel can look back upon no greater period than the days of David. And this is why, as I understand it, one of the important figures that is used is the throne of David. We're talking about the future glory of Israel in the Messiah. By the way, people tend to look upon the past as a golden age. People tend to look at the days of the foundation of the nation or kingdom as a glory day. The Romans did it, we recall in our study. Early Christians and early Christian history. So the world of the Bible in the first century, from the world of the first century BC, early first century AD, that Virgil glorified the Augustan age and pictured it as the return to the good old days. Well, Americans do this, don't they? We kind of long for a return to the good old days. You know, Archie Bunker saying, you know, girls were girls and men were men, and she might over sour and great, and didn't have no welfare state. Well, whether that's accurate or inaccurate, the point is that Israel could think of no greater glory than the days of David, the kingdom of David. And so, by the way, looking at this book, you don't get this in the scriptures, by the way. But in the days of David, it was a period in the history of the world, if you should recall, maybe not on Monday morning, that it was a period when there were only two strong, solidified central. There were no nations, we know them, but we won't say kingdoms. In the world, Egypt and Israel. It was a period of decentralization. The people from the north, the Sumerians, and the others, Dorians, others had moved down from the north, all into Greece, into what's now Turkey, and Asia Minor, of New Testament times, into the Balkans, over the Balkans, into the northern, what is now Iraq and Iran, and upset the apple cart, and it ushered in a dark age. That is, the glory days of Egypt had been over for a long time. The strong, vigorous Greek world, communities of the Aegean world, included the Greeks. Well, their glory was gone because the barbarians had moved in. The glories of the ancient Mesopotamian kingdoms were yet to come and were past. That is, the old Babylonian Empire had gone, and the Assyrians would not arise for another two centuries as a great power, maybe a century and a half. So there was no strong, that is, the scenes of the ancient the real estate, the land area, the ancient sophisticated monarchies, the Sumerians, the Mari and Nuzi and that age, the Amarna age, they were all gone in Egypt. So that the same thing had happened in the days of the Romans. These barbaric people, who are our ancestors, came down from the north and wiped out the Mediterranean civilization. So while Egypt was not quite so bad, Egypt was always an exception to everything. But what I'm trying to do is put this in a historical perspective, that in the days of David and his kingdom, I'm making two points. First of all, is that it loomed brighter and greater and more glorious in the minds of Israel because it stood in contrast to general cultural deprivation. That is, you realize that in Israel was about, except Israel and Egypt, were the only two places in the world where reading and writing was going on. as well, there was a literature being created so that the glory of David, of the Davidic kingdom, passed on to Solomon, loomed greater in their minds because of the contrast. That is, they had the best thing going in that day. Remember the Queen of Sheba came to visit Solomon and marvel? So that was Israel's day. This is my point. Do you see what I'm getting at? That was Israel's day in the sun. Other nations had overshadowed them before. Other nations would overshadow them later, but not then. Other nations envied them. Israel could look back on, could look at the to the east, where they would one day go into captivity and see desolation, confusion, and ruin. They would look at the sophisticated Minoan civilization and saw. And the glory days of Greece had not yet come. Now, so that's my first point, that the days of David loomed as the glory days, the golden age. Secondly, because this was true, and for other reasons, I'm sure, God used this as the paradigm, as the model for the future glory of Israel. That is, Israel in the Messiah is going to have a greater glory than she had under David. God is going to restore under a new shepherd, and we're going to talk about that next. But what I want to see is the thing of restoration when Israel is in captivity. The glory days are gone, and the prophets promise that God is going to build up again the throne of David. Literally? Well, no. That was the whole point. Now, however, the prophets never call for the complete rest, as far as the land is concerned, we talked about the land promise, and as far as the restoration is concerned, Israel was never promised a complete restoration in the sense of a reduplication of the Davidic kingdom. That, and by the way, even the most extreme dispensationalists would not hold for a complete restoration. They may talk about a literal restoration, but they don't really mean it. Why? Well, you see, to restore the kingdom, literally, the logic would not simply mean a return to the land, but it would mean the restoration of the political order. Well, it was impossible. The dispensationalists, by the way, are not prepared to live under the laws that were in effect in the days of David. And they had never called for their reestablishment. The original land allotments are impossible. And no call is made for that. And many dispensationalists chose at the idea of the reestablishment of the Mosaic religion. That's why you don't hear very much of that. It's there, it's logically there, but they choke at it. Scofield says that, I recall that, yes, we're going to restore animal sacrifice, but it will have a different significance. So you get the point that those who call for use the term restoration and call for a literal restoration to the land, they don't really want that. They don't. It's not literal. It simply is not to restore would mean to return. In other words, if you don't restore the laws of the kingdom, the political system, the religious system, and the land allotments, you haven't restored it. You got the point? That would be a restoration. Israel was not promised a restoration of the Davidic world. Israel was promised that they could return to the land, which they did. But that, while they would return to the land, and we see, that is, they go to Babylon in captivity, he says, you're going to come back. They'll come back in their kingdoms. So return is one thing. Restoration is another. So while Israel, here's the bottom line of all this, while Israel was promised a return to the land, and while while Davidic glory is the paradigm, you know what paradigm means? You ever send a doctor under a pleasant chamber, Jeff? Mike, and we got a lot of paradigms. Can you read the word? That's kind of technical word. Okay, number one, while they were promised a return to the land from the captivity which they enjoyed. Secondly, while and although the Davidic glory is the paradigm for messianic glory, that's a good way to put it. While the Davidic glory is the paradigm for messianic glory, Israel was never promised a literal restoration of the Davidic kingdom. And we're going to see that later on, but what I'm saying at this point is that no one would have ever expected it. And even the dispensationalists who cry for literalism, they don't expect it. That is, you're not going to restore the world of 1000 B.C. with its political system, its religious system, its laws, its social customs. You're not going to restore that. In fact, if you did, if you restore, by the way, well, listen to this, if you restore the Davidic monarchy in a way that was even close to what originally was in our world, it would not be a leading light in the world if it was the days of David because of the surrounding darkness, cultural darkness. It would be a fifth rate, backward, a third world joke, so it would be. The only point was it would not be, because it would just not fit in our world. Or any kind of way, it was bright because it stood in darkness. But it was not day. Well, what I'm saying is that Israel was never promised. You don't really expect that, even though they might say, yes, we take it literally, a restoration of the Davidic world, the Davidic system. That's what I meant by restoration versus return. Now, let me summarize again point C. Lo Ami and Ami, not my people and my people. Very, very critical point. In Romans 9, 24-27, where this site where it is cited, and let's return to that again. It was kind of a complex point, and by the way, the book of Romans is, remember I said that the dispensation, you have to take a hyperlinear view of the Old Testament and then interpret the New Testament, a lot of that particular verse. This is particularly true in the, especially in the book of Romans. Now, the point, I already made the point that the issue in Romans is whether or not the Jews are still a special people. And whether or not they can, God still owes them anything. But what's the answer in the book of Romans? No, there is no distinction. That God has kept his promises. This is a critical point, by the way. Now listen to me. A critical point. And Paul makes it, and it is implicit in the prophets, but not explicit. That Paul says that that salvation is not now by grace, the fact that they are born of Abraham, gives them a special standing. But that it never was. That's a very important point. That we often assume that all those who are under the Mosaic covenant are going to go to heaven. Well, that isn't true. It was not the keeping of the, for instance, he is not a Jew. Paul says he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, not by flesh, but by faith. He is a Jew, he is of Israel, he can claim promises if he has faith as Abraham had, not the flesh of Abraham, but the faith of Abraham versus the flesh of Abraham, And it has always been that way. That's the critical point, though. The Jews are wrong now thinking that way, and they were always wrong in thinking that way.
Can you discuss this last time? I destroyed the idea that this is not passage for predestination.
Right.
Idea. The causative words, the words that have show causative on the part of God, you understand me? Like God did not make
his causative.
Yes, it was. Yeah. But I still have trouble with, I was going over it yesterday, and I still have trouble with the idea of it being causative.
Well, it is causative. You see, the Bible does not teach that man has absolute free will to do anything you want to do at any time. The Bible teaches that man has moral free will in terms of his relationship to God. The fact that Pharaoh, as an example, the fact that Pharaoh could freely harden his heart against God, that does not mean that God could not cause Pharaoh to do certain things. It had nothing to do with his relationship to God as far as salvation is concerned. So with Israel, for people today, we say free will. We do not mean that God never manipulates in any way. That's not true. It is not absolute free will. In other words, moral free will is not the same thing as absolute freedom of action. Does that help you? And the issue was not Pharaoh's salvation, in the sense that he's not saying God, you would choose a son to have mercy on, he means in terms of his using them for his purposes, not salvation. And the argument is, if he leads to salvation, he doesn't have to do it, that the Jews are saved. If he uses, therefore he has to save us. He says, no, Pharaoh is the proof of that. He used Pharaoh, and it did not get Pharaoh off the hook. Now, but the point we make is that when he's, look at verse 24, Romans 9, 24 again, he also called not from among the Jews only, but also also from among Gentiles, as he says in Hosea, I will call those who were not my people. Now this indicates, it's very clear, that this is an illumination upon the Hosea text that you would not get from Hosea. That is, that what Paul is teaching is, that in the mind of God, national Israel were as the Gentiles. They become Gentiles because they were cast off. They were not his people. That's what Gentiles are, not his people. And so it's interesting. While the dispensationalists, while the Jews wanted to look at Hosea's prophecy this way, well, what Joel was teaching, what Hosea was teaching was this, that the Jews as a nation went into disgrace because they turned their back on God, right? And the day is going to come when those who are in disgrace, the Jews, are going to come back into favor. That's the scenario. However, Paul teaches us that it did not mean that at all. Now listen to me. Here's the point. That prophecy did not mean that the day would come when the Jews, as opposed to the Gentiles, would be restored to the favor of God in a special national kind of salvation. But that prophecy taught that all men would have opportunity to become the people of God. Look what he says. Whom he also called not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles, as he says in Hosea. Well, that kind of does violence to the idea of national salvation, doesn't it? Very important. Now, that's pretty clear, isn't it? The idea that the Jews, as a nation, are still special in the eyes of God is simply not true. There is no sin. Those who were once far off. In fact, that they were special, and that they had special, as Paul teaches in Romans, that somebody was saying, what advantage is there being a Jew there? And he says, much in every way, all kinds of privileges. and all kinds of opportunities. But it does not give you, there is no salvation by grace. And there never has been, he said. You know that, this is, remember I said in the beginning of this course that we cannot accept an eschatology that destroys sound of biblical theology. Well, this is absolutely fundamental. If the New Testament does not teach, there's no distinction between, in the mind of God and the plan of salvation, between Jews and between the Gentiles and Jews. It doesn't begin there. Now, if you point that out to dispensational, all he says is this. He says, well, that's true, there's no distinction in the church, but there will be in the millennium. Well, that's simply an assertion. You sort of have to close your eyes and whistle loudly as you tiptoe past the book of Romans and have the book of Galatians come up with that. You need to confirm that. But your affirmation is that he doesn't say, note this, he doesn't say, the Jews said, we had a special standing before the Messianic Kingdom, we'll have a special standing in the Messianic Kingdom. Dispensationalists say, same thing. Paul says, you do not have a special standing in the Messianic Kingdom, and you never had one then either. You did have one. He gets into the Romans 2. He said, right, those under the law sin, but those without the law, if they did the things contained in the law, they're justified. So, the fact that you were born of Israel is a thing. You were born of Israel and kept and had walked by faith, you were acceptable to God. But if you were not born of Israel and walked by faith, you were acceptable to God. And if you were born of Israel and did not walk by faith, you are not one of his children. You became a Gentile. No distinction. The promise seemed to be that Israel was chosen that they had special promises. As I said before, to sort of summarize it, Israel thought that they were chosen to rule. Chosen for favor in that sense. They were not, they were chosen to minister, serve, not to rule. And by the way, you see, character of the uniqueness of Israel is personified in Jesus. Jesus was special, chosen to do what? Well, he was chosen. This is the great nature. Jesus said, he would be greatest among you is what? Servant of all. Jesus has never got that message. Romans would laugh at that. Who's the greatest? Well, fell down from the slave out of the barn. He's the greatest one in the household. Wait a minute. Not this world. Well, you got that Israel's greatness was to be what the greatness of the Messiah was. Greatness in service. Greatness in love. Greatness in faith. Not greatness in there was not a Jewish world empire. Well, we'll leave that part. Come now to race versus grace. Ephesians 5:22-15. By the way, when I say salvation by race, I mean the doctrine that anyone, because of the accident of birth, has a special standing before God in the sense that they have a special opportunity for salvation or a special kind of salvation or both. Ephesians 2:12-15. Remember, he's writing to you, well, look at verse 11. Therefore, remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, you with me? Ephesians 3:11. Ephesians 2:11. Therefore, for the formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by the so-called, look at so-called circumcision. What does he say so-called? Yeah, because he taught the book of Romans that circumcision of the flesh didn't mean a thing, and there was no circumcision of the heart. You could be set apart physically, under the covenant sign of circumcision.
But if your heart was not set aside unto God, it'd make any difference.
By the way, that was the point Jesus was making with Nicodemus. That was the born of the flesh of Christ. That was the spirit of spirit. You've got to be said, you've got to be born again. The point he's making is that being born of Abraham did not do it. Again, spiritually. Okay. Remember that you were, at that time, separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world. But now Christ Jesus, you, with Israel's benefits, he explains in the book of Romans, you had the promises, you had the opportunities, you had the covenants, but you didn't use them. In other words, the fact that you had them made you special, but you have no claims upon God because you did not take advantage of them, even more than Gentiles did. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall. By the way, the wall has been excavated. It's probably stood in the temple area, dividing the Gentiles from the Jews. Gentiles could not go past those points, you know that? By abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments containing in ordinances, that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, and having put to death the enmity, he came and preached peace to those who were far away, and peace to those who were near, Jews and Gentiles alike. For through him we both have our access in one spirit to the Father, so that you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens of the saints and of God's household, and so forth. Galatians 3:28-29. By the way, God, I'll just make this category of statement. God broke down the wall between, so there's no distinction. And any religion that built up that wall, the false religion. I'll say way around that. Any religion that reestablishes that wall, the false religion. And did that not follow? So Galatians 3:28-29. What does it say? There is neither Jew nor Greek. Slave or free man, whether male or female, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. And, know this, and if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. How many are Jews? We are. What does it say that? If by Jew you mean Abraham's offspring, well then, we're Abraham's offspring. Heirs upon the promise. That's pretty clear, isn't it? The tabernacle of David, by the way, let's look at Amos 9:11-12, and then the side. This, by the way, this is an absolutely key text in the instruction of the hope of Israel. Amos, let's turn back to Amos 9. Amos, I think it's Amos 11. My people will die with the sword. Those who say that the calamity will not overtake or confront us, in that day I will raise up the fallen booth or tabernacle of David. What was the tabernacle of David? Well, in idiomatic language, means the system David in his household. and wall up its breaches. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old. The rebuilding of the Davidic tabernacle. I will raise it up. Okay, fair enough? Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that he is going to come and it's going to be rebuilt? Tabernacle of David? Literally, physically, nationally? Look at Acts 15, 14 through 17. Acts 15, this is very, very important. Remember how he used, remember how Paul uses the lo ami, ami Hosea text? Interesting, that's a parallel here. This is Paul, Peter speaking. But James is speaking at this point. Remember, this is the Jerusalem conference. What was the issue? What was the Jerusalem conference over? What was the problem? Okay. Gentiles making coming into the church, and the Jews, who have been very Jewish culturally all along, said, were saying, wait a minute, these people have to be circumcised as they keep the Sabbath, and there are dietary laws. And the council said, no, they don't. By the way, the Seventh-day Adventists point out that the Jewish Christians in the first century kept the Sabbath, and they did. But the point is that but it was no longer binding, therefore they could not bind it upon Gentiles. They could keep it if they wanted to, but it was not the law of God. Well, anyway, James speaks. Now listen to this. This is verse 14. James says, brother, listen to me. Simeon, that's Peter, has related how God first concerned himself about taking from among the Gentiles a people for his name. James has told us that God is calling out the Gentiles. And with this, the words of the prophet agree. Prophets prophesied this. Lo and behold, what prophet does he cite? Well, the one we just read from Amos. After these things, I will return and will rebuild the tabernacle of David, which has fallen. I will rebuild his ruins, and I will restore it, in order that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, and all the Gentiles who are called by name, says the Lord, who makes things known from of old. Note this. James cites this prophecy as a prophecy of the calling of Jews and Gentiles together into the one church. But he said, look what's happening. The Jews, the Gentiles are coming into the church right along with the Jews. Well, the prophets prophesied this. The day is going to come when, remember, the old tabernacle is gone. The old temple is gone. The day is going to come when God's going to rebuild the tabernacle of David. Where? In Jerusalem. Rebuilding of the temple. Key passage. That passage means that God's going to... No, it doesn't. James says, here's what it means. It meant that there's going to be a new tabernacle, a spiritual tabernacle. And it was promised that Jews and Gentiles would join one another in it. Well, does that not harmonize with Paul's use of the Lo-Ami-Ami text? Yeah. It all comes together. Very critical point. Now we come to the throne of David, and just as the phrase, the hope of Israel, was a formula, a rubric, a statement of the, which sort of captured and capsulized and summarized, well, so we have another one now called the sure mercies of David. You got to know that. Well, the hope of Israel, the sure mercies of David. That's based upon 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16, as I give you here. By the way, according to Acts, it's actually this question.
whether it be true or false, according to the book of Acts, the tabernacle of David has already been set up. Well, James said, isn't it? True. By the way, they didn't say a thing about the millennium or the future. He said that prophecy covers what is now happening. Okay. Act 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16. Now, looking at the sure mercies of David. Here's the basis of that phrase. David is trying to build. You recall that David planned the temple to replace the tabernacle. Did David build it? Who did build it? Why did David not build it? He's a bloody man. He had been too much involved in death. Too much of a warrior. By the way, David was a fearsome warrior. Very large and very strong. Just too rough a little boy to build a temple. His heart, his mind just wasn't right. But God, when he says no to David, he gives him a promise for the future of his people. Even from that day that I command judges, this is verse 11, to be over my people, Israel, I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declared that to you, that the Lord will make a house for you. This is very beautiful, by the way. Good sermon. David said, I'm going to make a house. By the way, good sermon on grace. David said, I want to make a house for God. God says, no, you sin too much. And I can't let you make a house, it wouldn't be wise. It wouldn't be good. David had a reputation in the world. Now, Solomon got a reputation of a different kind later on, after he built the temple. But David had a reputation going in. He was a man of slaughter. He had killed his thousand. I mean, his 10,000. Wouldn't look good. But his heart was, he had a good heart, but you can imagine the nations of the world. If there was one of the leading nations in the world, what they would have said about it. You hear what David did? It'd be like, if enemy would, that'd be like, the head of the mafia building a church. That's a rough analogy, but we would not say it'd be like that, if enemies would. Right? So God says, can't let you do it. But here's what David, while you cannot build a house for me, I'll build a house. The grace of God. You like that? That'd be a good sermon. Well, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, that's while you're in the grave, you see, I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come forth from you. And I'll raise up your descendants after you. Sorry, this is the Messiah. Who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be the father to him. He will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and with the strokes of the sons of men, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, and your throne shall be established forever. Now, by the way, verse 14 should be translated, I think, if he commits iniquity, not when he commits iniquity. Isn't this great? He said, I'll build a household for you. David, I can't let you do what you want to do, but I'm going to make you get something better. I'll give you a promise. That after you die, your nation, one will be born of you, and he will build. Now, he's talking about Solomon.
Seems like it. He's talking about establishing the throne forever, and that would be Messiah, but because the throne, in a sense, was established forever by the man of David, and Jesus taking the throne in heaven.
Well, it's talking, but this house he's going to build, it was not Solomon. It was the Messiah. that because he said, I will, and everybody understood this. The key was, he was saying, I will not, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him. See that phrase? As it did from Saul. Well, now, did God judge Solomon? Well, not during his days. Well, anyway, this may be one of those prophecies. If it has reference to Solomon, it'd be like Emmanuel, that it was they looked down into the future as well. This is commonly accepted as one of the, so this prophecy became to the Jews, it was called the sure mercy of David. They got it from the phrase, my loving kindness shall not depart from him. My mercies will be sure. That is, God set Saul up and then allowed him to fall, right? And God set David up, but David fell into disfavor. But one is going to come who will never fall into disfavor, whose kingdom will never be destroyed. In other words, the point is, my mercies will not depart from him as they did from Saul. The sure mercies of the, you understand that? The sure mercies.